Profitable idealism.
Hey everybody, it's Johnny B. Truant. I am here with Jared Angaza, President, CEO of Keza, and that is K-E-Z-A, Keza.com. And Keza is really just a prime example of profitable idealism. It would be hard to find a better example of it that better suits the parameters that Pace and I have been talking about and have been developing. Jared was introduced to us by Chris Guillebeau, who is another one of the people that we're talking to and who is also very profitable idealism-minded. So this is an excellent little constellation. So first of all, Jared, thanks for being on the call.
Happy to be here, man.
So I wonder if you could start out, we're using you just sort of as a case study for how you can make money, make a profit, at the same time as you're improving the world. And of course, our contention is that both of those things aren't just things that you can sort of shoehorn into a situation where they're working together, but that they're actually very complementary. And your model, when we talked before, I found that to be exactly true. So can you give the big picture of what exactly it is that Keza does?
Absolutely. We spent a lot of years in philanthropy and humanitarianism and aid work, missions, whatever you want to call it. And, a decade or so that I've been working in that field, and in that time also doing business ventures, entrepreneurial endeavors. I was running a private equity firm in Nashville, and I've always had this mixing of philanthropy in my life and then business in my life, however keeping them separate until the last half of that decade, I guess the last 5 years, and really just been putting it together. We have an organization now called Keza that is, which means beautiful in Kinyarwanda, which is, we formed this in Rwanda over the last 5 years. And it's an ethical fashion label. We are producing all of the products in Africa with indigenous artisans, primarily in East Africa. The purpose of Keza, above and beyond just creating jobs and income in Africa, is to affect the image of Africa and what we expect from Africa. Typically, people don't expect much, and we want to change that with showcasing the beauty and excellence of what is possible in Africa. We see all the doom and gloom in the media, but that's certainly not the full scope. So that's what Keza is. We make high-end fashion products, and we've blended this idea of business and philanthropy at the same time, and I have lots of opinions on that whole dynamic, but Keza is kind of epitomizes our thoughts on what ethical business should look like.
What I really love about this is that it's like you said, changing the image that Africa has. And when we spoke before, you were talking about, I mean, let's have you say it. What do people expect from Africa? Like if I said I have some African jewelry that I want to show you, what do people expect?
Well, it's interesting. Me being in the business that I'm in, even when people tell me, hey, we've got some African jewelry we want to show you, I start to get this gag reflex going because I know what I'm typically going to see, and it's going to be some trinket stuff that should be or would be sold in the flea market at best. And that's typically what we're going to see coming from Africa. And it shows up in missions departments and churches and places like that. That's the expectation. We expect inferior products and services and just about everything else from Africa. However, again, that's not the full scope. And there are amazing artists and entrepreneurs there all over Africa. And I mean, keeping in mind, Africa's about three times larger than the United States. So there's a lot going on there. Not to mention the resources that are available there, which are also dramatically more than what we'd find in the United States. So all the ingredients are there. But there's this, there's this mentality there that we've sort of imposed, we being the West, over the years, and that's again this inferiority idea, and it's that we don't expect much, and consequently, we're not looking for excellence when we go there. When Westerners go to Africa, they're not expecting to see excellence. They're expecting to see kids in orphanages and kids with flies on their face, and and AK-47s and whatnot. And, if you go to the right places, you will see that. But that's certainly not the whole deal. So There's a quote by John Steinbeck where he says, it's the nature of man to rise to greatness when greatness is expected of him. And it's the last part of that sentence that's pretty important. When you expect it, you get different results.
Right.
And we expect crap. And half the time, that's what we get. We go and we help start a cooperative or something like that. And we make some little trinkets and come back and sell them and try to do some good. And you know, and that's cool. And it serves its purpose. But if we're going to do business, we need to go well beyond that.
Well, I definitely see what you're saying there, because the image of, as you said, the kids and the flies with their face with the distended bellies and sort of the Sally Struthers model of African charity, mm-hmm. it seems like, and you know, you've been there a lot more than I have, because I've been there, I haven't been there, so therefore you've been there more than I have. Mm-hmm. my impression is that a lot of that has to be perpetrated, not in a conspiracy sort of a way, but in order to get donations. I mean, just as sort of a weird metaphorical example, I'm diabetic, and my mom used to be involved with the JDF, juvenile diabetes, and she said that they don't want me as kind of the image of the thing because I'm too, like, I'm in control. You know, they want the kids who are, like, losing legs and stuff, because if it doesn't look bad, then people aren't compelled to donate. And I really like your model instead, and the perception of, we don't just want to give them the fish, but we want to teach them how to fish. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. The topic that you just pinpointed right there is very important. There's a cycle that's been created by the aid world. And I want to preface this too by saying that I'm in no way coming down on nonprofits or the aid agencies or whatever. There's a ton of great ones out there, and a lot of them that I work with and consult for and all kinds of stuff all the time. However, I'm talking about business. In this aid world mentality that we see in Africa, there is this cycle where a nonprofit says, hey, we've got to raise money so that we can help Africans. And if we're going to help these poor Africans, then we're going to need to generate money to do that. And if we're going to do that, we don't want to show the people that are doing great. We want to show the people that are doing horrible. So now it's become like this competition, even amongst aid agencies, to see who can show the worst side of Africa. And you could enter in any developing country here, but Africa is certainly at the top of the list typically. So we see this almost competition thing where people are showing the worst case scenario of what's going on. And so that you have that over on this side. And then on the other side, you have the fact that if these aid agencies were to actually create independency with those that they serve, their beneficiaries, so say they start a cooperative and that cooperative starts doing well and becomes independent of the aid agency, that aid agency, if I'm just looking at dollars and cents and I'm the CFO of that aid agency, I'm going to look and see that we just lost an income generator because we created independence, which is our mission. Now, that's unfortunately the scenario that we're dealing with a lot of aid agencies, is that they're showing the worst case scenarios so that they can get money and use that money to create a program that creates independence. But if they actually create independence, they lose the program. And there's all kinds of things that tie into that, even with budgets. And, you know, if they get 200,000 budget 1 year and then they use 150,000 of it, they don't get 200,000 next year, they get 150,000.
Right.
So there's motivation to be inefficient within those agencies as well. There's a lot of things that just haven't worked. And my main care and passion on this earth is pretty altruistic. If I could just go out there and do philanthropy and not even have the business side attached, I'd probably just do that. But that's not the world we live in. So we've got to be realistic about how we go about it. And it's got to be self-sustainable. I don't like the idea of going and begging for money to go start a business like we see often. And if we're going to run a business for Africa, it ought to be a business. And that's, you know, that's how we're doing it.
So let's delve a little bit more into what exactly is Zitkeza does. So you have local artists and you eventually want to end up showcasing their stuff as high-end jewelry. Can you take me through how that process works?
Yeah. We've had quite a few renditions of this business model and different structures throughout the years. And what we've resolved to now is one where we go into different areas, typically in East Africa. I'll just give you an example of what we would do. We would go into Mombasa, which is where we're heading in a month, to find artisans that are creating products that are already kind of at a higher level. So we're looking for the best of the best in the area, realizing that if we're going to create a new image for Africa, we ought to do it with the best artisans we can find. So we're doing that where we go into an area and we may go to stores, boutiques, markets, things like that around town that are selling products, find products that we like, track down those artists, which is typically easy to do in that area. Or we come into contact with an aid agency or something like that, and they turn us on to some artists that they may be working with. And that's typically a good scenario for us because if they're working with an aid agency, there's some sort of assumption there that they're already kind of getting some westernized guidelines on quality control and all that. So that's an attractive client for us. So we would go and work with them, or kind of assess what their business looks like. And we go in very low key, very under the radar, under promise and over deliver is certainly the way we want to do it. So when we do that, we come in and agree to work with an artist just on helping them to expand their design capabilities is step one. And we do that by bringing in other designers from the United States and specifically from Rhode Island School of Design, RISD. And we have a partnership with, they send over interns for about 4 months throughout the summer. And they spend 4 months on the ground with us, with the artisans working in the artisans' studios or workshops or whatever. So we're working with them on their turf, which again.
And Jared, where would people know Rhode Island School of Design, just so we have that out there?
Well, RISD is now recognized as being probably the top fashion school in the United States, which makes it one of the higher ranking in the world. And the most popular thing that's come out of there, other than a few major designers, Obey Propaganda, their label came out of there, and then Project Runway came out of there, and which we watch on TV and many people seem to love as
Seem to love. Okay. I didn't mean to interrupt your flow, but I just wanted to. I'm not a design guy, so I wanted to get that out there.
that's all good.
Yeah.
So we bring over the interns, and these are cream of the crop designers, and they come over and essentially are there to expand the artist's capabilities for American consumption goods. As not to say that their designs aren't great in Africa, but they need to be altered a bit in order to sell here in the high-end boutiques. So we do that with them and take all the cultural things, the stories, all of the ancestry behind each material and each piece that's created. And really showcase that and package it in a way that is desired by the United States market. So that's the process for design. Once that's done and we have some pieces, they're welcome to sell those locally. And they can do that well because a lot of them are in touristy areas and a lot of people coming through there. We typically work in larger cities. So that gives them a local market immediately that they're welcome to sell and create an income from that. And when we come in on the sales side, we bring examples of their pieces. We may buy 50 or 100 pieces, bring them back to the United States. We take them to our PR company. They get them out to celebrity stylists and directly to celebrities and for big events, red carpet affairs, and all that. And then we put them in fashion shows. Obviously, then take them to our sales reps that ultimately get them out to vendors. And that's how it happens. A vendor puts in an order, we go back and we help facilitate that order, and that's how the whole thing starts up. And it's different for every individual.
So just to clarify a little bit from the marketing perspective, from the non-CAESA perspective, but from the broader world that some of the people listening to this might be able to relate, it's essentially like you're taking an existing product, like sort of a diamond in the rough, really, and it's really like marketing advice, marketing and sales advice and coaching and so forth, to allow them to take, and this is important, a product that is already good and make it better, rather than to either take crap and hawk it, or to, institute some sort of like a donation, or to institute a reliance mentality where they're just taking stuff.
Exactly. Yeah, and we've seen the donor mentality. It's been horrible over the years, and it's something that we have to combat a lot. And even coming in as a for-profit business, doing what we do, a lot of times the assumption on the African side is that we're there to donate money to them. It doesn't matter how loud and proud we are about being a for-profit and being a business and all that. It's still a constant battle. We've been working with groups of women in Rwanda for 5 years straight, day in and day out, living there with them every day, and still battle that mentality. And it's just something that's been pounded into them for generations and generations by the West.
What's the Immanuel Kant quote that you said you use all the time about beauty?
Immanuel Kant, he spoke often about beauty, but one of the things he said was that in order for a person to, I'm paraphrasing, but in order for a person to truly appreciate beauty, the atmosphere must be optimal. There's a lot of backstory to that, but to drive it home, a story that I typically tell, it's one about, Jackson Pollock, mm-hmm. great painter, painted some crazy looking stuff, lots of splatters and dots and whatever. And the average Joe may look at that and think, whatever, it's a splatter paint picture, that's great. And if you put that up in a high school and say, my kid did it, then, you may get a few nods and people would say, oh, that's cool. However, a Jackson Pollock painting is a Jackson Pollock painting. It has the brand Jackson Pollock behind it. There's a story behind him. There's an assumption of his quality and excellence. And his paintings are typically shown in places like Museum of Modern Art, MoMA. And people come in like David Geffen and buy them for $140 million, which he just purchased one for. Mm-hmm. And I just spoke to a university, Bradley University up in Illinois, and I used this as an example and showed a picture and showed the exact picture that David Geffen bought. Environment matters. When you're, if we're selling African products at a flea market, there's a perception that goes along with that. If those same pieces are sold at Barney's or Bergdorf Goodman or Bloomingdale's, there's an entirely different perceived value that's attached to that product. And this is certainly a great way to attach a higher perceived value to Africa as a whole.
And what's amazing about that, and what's so great about this approach, is that because you're working in the field of jewelry, which is something that doesn't have inherent value in the way that food does, or shelter, or something that people need. It's something that is, the value is up in the air, and nobody strictly needs it, is that by working in that field, you're able to add value by adding the perceptual element to it. And that allows you to, I don't want to speak for you, but we're going to get into this in a little bit, but it allows you to create a profit margin for the individual artists and for you, essentially out of air. Is that correct?
Pretty much so. And that's very much how the fashion industry works. It's not utilitarian. Nobody needs jewelry. Some would argue that, but no one really needs jewelry. You wear jewelry to make a statement. I wear earrings or a necklace or whatever, or my wife takes out a different purse for every occasion, or shoes or whatever. And it's to make a statement. Fashion is something we use to say who we are and how we think and all those kind of things. Part of the reason I wanted to attach this art to Africa or attach the art of Africa to the United States is because it is something that is more personal too. And when you know the story behind the person that created your art, whether it be someone like Jackson Pollock or it be, this amazing African artist that we create this biography for and show you who this person really is and start to showcase their excellence, there's something beautiful that happens in that. We often work with groups of women that have been in horrible situations, suffice it to say, and have been stripped of any sort of sense of self-worth or dignity or whatever. And when we are connecting them in this way to be able to create a piece of jewelry that then another woman in the United States, the UK, or wherever puts on to go on to some red carpet event, and she feels that it makes her more beautiful and all these things that a woman feels when she puts on the jewelry, that's a beautiful kind of connection between the artist and the end consumer. And it's so much different than if we were creating, doormats or blenders that are utilitarian. There's a very different vibe that comes from that. In this case, it helps to build a lot of dignity in the artists that we're working with.
Yeah, you don't need to sell me on that. I mean, my thing has been story selling or the use of story to sell. And so that's exactly right up my alley. I actually wrote a post for Etsy advising that exact approach, tell the stories behind your product.
Absolutely.
Yeah, which was great. So can you take me through the profit model? I mean, how exactly does that work? How do you make your money? I know you're very, very transparent about your business. So how does that work out for everybody?
Well, when we take a product, first of all, we have a fashion panel, which we've assembled all kinds of fashion experts and celebrities and whatnot that have had their finger on the pulse of fashion, suffice it to say. And we take whatever products, prototypes that we create in Africa, we send either pictures or actual product, whichever we are able to do at the time, to send back to our fashion panel, most of which reside in New York. And they go over those pieces, help us critique them and figure out what we need to do to change them, and then ultimately help us price them. Once they've priced and given a price saying, okay, this would sell for this much if it were at Barney's. And we say, okay, that gives us kind of a range to start working with. And then we then price back and say, okay, what are the COGS of this product? What does it take to get the materials? What does it take to get all the materials into the shop? What's a fair wage for the artist to make on it? And so on. And then we start to kind of come up with this formula. And we have a sort of an exact formula on this, but we're ultimately pricing the product that we purchase from the artist relative to the price that we're going to sell it for in the United States. For the first time, an African artist is getting paid according to the end retail price as opposed to just the street price. I mean, we have products, for instance, and I'll give you actual numbers that I could go buy on the street in Rwanda for $5. And that artist would say, okay, thank you. I'm glad I got this $5. And they'd be pretty happy about it. Now, I know for a fact that a lot of times that happens at a loss because they're not factoring in their COGS and everything else. So even if I said $10, I could sell it and still do all right and be fairly ethical. And in many cases, still be within fair trade principles. And I could get a fair trade certification, even if I was just paying a little bit more than minimum wage. However, we are pr pricing and paying at a rate where instead of paying $5 for that item, I'm more likely to pay $30 for that item. And then I'm selling it for, $60, $70. And then it's retailing for twice that, $140 or whatever. And that's a typical way that it would work if I went to Italy and paid an artist to make a product and came back here and sold it in the United States. Unfortunately, that process is never really applied to developing nations. We always just go in and buy what we want for the least amount of money. And it's not according to the intrinsic value or even the perceived value that could come of it from the US market. So when we do that, that's the how the pricing structure works. And then where we make money is when we help to price it for the artist so that they're getting paid a much more than fair, but a profitable wage on that product. And then we take it and offer a wholesale price to the end vendor. And that would be a boutique or department store or whatever. And then we charge a premium on that for facilitating that deal. And that's where we make our money.
Okay, so
So we're
to.
making money from the vendor.
Right. And at the same time, you're helping make money for the creator, which is fantastic.
We sort of ensure that the artist is getting paid what we call a profitable wage, not a fair wage, but a profitable wage.
Well, and another thing I think is important to point out, and take me through the details of this because I just have scattered notes, is that you're sort of acting as a broker or a middleman. I mean, correct? You aren't going and buying up a ton of necklaces, for instance, and then warehousing them and then turning around and reselling them. You are essentially acting as a middleman in some manner. Is that correct? So
Absolutely.
you aren't owning their rights or their merchandise at any point and then have a license to resell. You're just allowing them to sell to an enhanced marketplace, correct?
Yes, for the most part. However, there's one addition in that we do sell it under the Kayser brand. So it's always branded Kayser, it's packaged Kayser, and all that, which ultimately helps the artist on the other end again, because then their product isn't showing up in a banana leaf. It's showing up in very nice packaging and very high-end packaging that would be required for them to have in order to sell to that vendor in the first place.
Right, part of the perception.
Yeah.
Okay, so the big picture question then is, do you think, and I don't know which way you're going to answer this, so we'll see, is do you think that this venture, that the profit side of this venture where you're making money and it's literally a business, do you think that would work as well without the idealism component? And then second part of the question, do you think that the philanthropic, moral duty that you're having here, that trying to improve the culture of Africa, improve the image of Africa, do you think that would work as well if this weren't a profitable venture and were strictly some sort of donation, which we've already kind of talked about.
Well, to answer the second part of that quickly, well, it works on a small level. It'll never work on a large level. If it's just a philanthropic or a humanitarian type of venture where you're going out and there are lots of nonprofit organizations out there that are selling jewelry and doing all right, but you're not going to see them in Neiman Marcus, and you're not going to see them doing it on larger levels in terms of volume or in terms of perceived value, which results in a higher price point. We've seen that happen over the years. You can even make it work sort of as a business in the United States, but it doesn't teach a man to fish, which we covered before. It sort of puts them in this position where, again, they're receiving, they being the African artisans, are receiving a somewhat of a handout. Now, they worked a little bit for it, but it's really just a step above a handout. Mm-hmm. So there's the answer to that. Now, to answer your first question, are you asking if it would work as a business here without the humanitarian aspect on the other side, like the story on the other side?
Well, since I'm the profit side of the Pace-Johnny duo here, Pace was the idealism side. She and her partner Kylie started out with the intention of changing the world, discovered that the best way to make their impact was by creating a business. Now, I'm the flip side. I started out just intending to make money, found that the best way to do that was to help as many people as possible. And I did things like promotions where I would set up blogs for free and so forth. So it's a smaller scale and it's a less obvious kind of quote-unquote making the world better. But I discovered that my profit, which was my main driver, was enhanced by adding some sort of a selfless component to it. And I guess that's my question is, do you think that you could go in with just the intention of we're going to get necklaces and we're going to resell them? And be totally honest, I mean, if you think that you could do just as well, please tell me. I'm just curious to see whether you think you could do as well without this molding the artists and creating sustainable value and all that stuff.
The benevolent side or what? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, I think we could do it to some degree, but I think ultimately it will unravel. And we've seen it happen over and over again where it starts to unravel. I wish I could give examples, but I don't want to give any names. There are situations that happen like that where you can go in and you can do the business side of it. And even in an exploitative way, where you're taking advantage of an artisan, and you can still come over here and make money. But ultimately, because, to be frank, largely due to the transparency that the internet has created, you can't really get away with it for long. It starts to unravel, and you also end up with artists and communities and whatnot on the Africa side that start to get burned out and start to understand that they're getting taken advantage of, and so on. So I think there are different levels, that being the worst, and the next one being that we just come over and we just kind of do business and we're not really teaching them or helping them or whatever. And yeah, I mean, that provides an income, at least for a period of time. But I think that ultimately there's got to be kind of a melding of all of those things, of teaching, helping them to understand business better, helping them to understand their market better, how to market themselves, how to brand themselves specifically, mm-hmm. and brokering those deals. And ultimately, I mean, we'd love to create enough of a trend on the Africa side that we're not needed as much or at all anymore. Now, for us to be needed to some degree, it doesn't defeat the whole point of this at all. I mean, we have brokers all over the world. They serve a purpose.
Right.
So I think that, we want more artists to be connected to the international market, and in this case, the fashion market. And this is, I think, a stepping stone to get us there.
Well, your answer essentially seems to boil down to, yes, you could probably make as much money, but it would unravel. I would say that means that, no, it wouldn't work as well then. And the reason I would say that is because the same is true. I mean, I'm in a volatile market. If you call me an internet marketer, which I try to not have people call me, we're well known for sort of the smash and grab internet marketer, where the idea is you can make a ton of money with quasi-ethical sort of gray area tactics that basically deliver nothing and have a ton of hype. And so the answer is, well, strictly, can you make a lot of money by not being an ethical business person? The answer is, well, yes, but, like you said, not sustainably. You're constantly getting new customers because the old ones have been ripped off by you. You're fighting SEO results for your name on like the ripoff report and stuff like that. it's ultimately sort of a house of cards. So I entirely agree that it's like, yeah, you can get away with it, but for how long?
You know, and people do. People get away with unethical business all the time. I wrote a blog not too long ago about social entrepreneurialism, and we have this new term of social entrepreneurs and mm-hmm. and ethical capitalism and so on. And my thought was, when did we allow business practices, general business practices, to get so bad that exploitation became the norm, and then we had to create a new term called social entrepreneur that basically means we don't screw the people we work with. It's pretty phenomenal that it's come to that in business. But I think that we have these trends of, you know, we're trading and bartering in teepees one day, and which if we had it my way, I'd go back to that. But we've got that, and then we moved into, you know, a little heavier on the demand side, which created more business, and that led us into the Industrial Revolution. And then we've got mass quantities of everything and mass consumption, mass production, and all that. Now we've come to this point where we are now, which is what I just said, with the social entrepreneurial vibe coming in and people starting to say, hey, this old model's not working. We're killing the earth. We're killing people. This is bad news. Not to mention, again, with the transparency of the internet, it also kills your image, which kills your bottom line. Mm-hmm. And you know that. So I think the next step then is moving more towards that personal connection in business. And we're seeing that with social forums starting to explode all over the place and growing and growing and growing because people want more personal interaction. And now we're seeing that to transform into meetups. And we see it in the business world with products where people want to know the backstory. They want to know how it was created. They want to know it didn't impact the earth negatively, that it's sustainable and recyclable and blah, blah, blah. There's a lot of these trends in business that we've seen throughout the years that this ebb and flow of ethical practices. And I think we're now moving more into a flow of ethical practices. And I think business has to be that way to some degree to work now. People expect it out of you. They expect you to be involved with some sort of humanitarian endeavor of some kind. And if you're not, people are kind of like, hey, what's wrong with these guys?
Well,
which is great.
It's funny because I was just looking the other day for free-range eggs or something. I liked the idea of the local farmer with the chickens and so forth. And so you start looking around for this and it's like, well, cage-free means this, but there's this other bad thing going on. And then, you know, this other term, organic doesn't mean anything. It just means that they are, I don't know, fed an organic grain diet. And it's like you have to cut through so much crap that it's really funny to me that you mentioned the social entrepreneurism movement, because that's something that I'm going to ask Mark Silver about from Heart of Business. I'm going to talk to Mark a little while later, and Pace said specifically, ask Mark about the social entrepreneurism thing. So it's really funny that you brought it up, but it is interesting when you boil it down. It really sort of says, we don't screw our customers, which in my sphere, that's the third tribe marketers. Hey, we're marketers, but we're not going to screw you. Like, why is that necessary even to say that at all? That's amazing.
Yeah. Yep.
So that kind of leads into something else that I was going to ask you about, and that was because you are working in an atmosphere where Africans have been exploited to some degree by the archetype of the white man coming over to do whatever, how do you build that relationship, and is it rocky at first, and or was it rocky at first, and did it take work, and how does that work?
Yes, it's rocky at first, and understandably so. There's certainly been a lot of other folks that look like I do to some degree, sans tattoos, but has looked like I do, you know, coming over that made big promises. They call it the white elephant, and comes over, makes big promises. Things don't happen in our timeline. And then we get disinterested and then walk away. And you start to get people groups and communities that get really burned out and jaded because of that. And they're like, hey, we know how you guys roll. You come over here, you make big promises, and then things don't happen the way you want, and you roll out. So we're coming up against that perspective often. And then there's also the perspective that if we are there, we're just a dollar sign. And I've had extremely highly educated African, I won't name countries, but African folks come up to me in Africa and say, look, we know that white people are rich, all white people, and you cannot convince us otherwise. And I'm thinking, you know, and this is when I first moved there, I had about 2 cents to rub together, maybe, and I was barely eating and supporting other kids and blah, blah, blah. Hearing that, it was kind of devastating in the early days, because I felt like, really, this is the environment that I now have to contend with. And we see it all the time. And you see, Americans come over and they're handing out $20 bills to kids on the streets. And I'm sitting there thinking, great, now every kid that I pass on the street on the way to work every single day of my life is going to think I'm going to give him 20 bucks. Not to mention the fact that when you give that kid 20 bucks, he's probably going to get beat up on his way home because all the other kids are going to want it. And that kid could lose his life because of your quote unquote generosity. And really what it was is just easier way for you to feel like you did something good than to sit down and spend some time talking to that kid and investing in his life. And that's the dynamic that we're battling so often in Africa. So we've got on top of struggling economy in many of these areas and lack of resources and business practices and knowledge of that, we're also contending with that dynamic that I just laid out. That is the ripple effect from years and years of aid dependency. And I don't mean to sound jaded about it. Obviously, I'm not just sitting around griping about it. I'm doing something about it, as are many, many, many others. I think that the aid agency world, if you were to make it all one big vehicle, it's like the Titanic, and turning that bad boy around is difficult. So it's going to take some time, but I think it is starting to turn around. And aid agencies already are, and even churches, missions groups, and stuff are starting to realize that that's not quite how you do things. I also run a just a philanthropy consulting business, and we just got hired by another church up in Jersey that wants to do a program in Rwanda, and they're looking at it and saying, "Look, we realize that a lot of the old school techniques aren't working anymore, and we understand that it would be in our best efforts to hire someone like you to go over and help facilitate." And here we are. So those kind of things are exciting to me when even churches and missions groups are coming and saying, "Okay, old school ways aren't working, that we need to figure out a better way so that this is more sustainable and it's really serving the people we're there to serve and not just serving our own agenda to feel like we did something good." I tend to be a glass half full kind of guy, so I think it's going the right way.
Well, one of the things that you said before was a quote by Bono, said Africa needs trade, not aid. And I thought that was a really good way to encapsulate the whole concept of let's educate rather than just give.
Yeah, and I mean, Bono gets plenty of flack from all over the place, but at the end of the day, that man's done more for Africa than probably any other person on the planet. And there's actually a quote from Nelson Mandela saying that, if you need any more clout than that. He's done his research and he's spent a lot of time there since 1982. And he first came out with saying, "Look, Africa wants opportunities, not handouts." That then very quickly moved into trade, not aid. And there are times for aid. There are times when we need to drop thousands of pounds of food from World Food Program into Darfur or DRC when there's a horrible thing, whatever is going on, and all the civil wars and whatnot. But when you're moving into even a place like Kigali, Rwanda, which is very established, the business structure is very solid, they're very progressive, they're a technology hub. They don't need a food program. They need businesses. They need jobs. Even when you talk about reforming the education system, and it does need to be reformed in Africa very much. But for what reason? If I'm an African kid and I go to school, why do I even want to go to school? And knowing that I don't have enough money to leave my country and there's no jobs in my country to be had, what's the point? Why not just stay home and farm? At least I know I can eat. There's got to be more business opportunities to even compel someone to go and finish school in the first place. So, I mean, I think there's got to be, it's got to be simultaneous to some degree. But I have a good friend, James Pearson, that runs a company called Ember Arts. It's emberarts.com. And they've been operating in Uganda for a long time. And he's written a lot under the title Business Can Change the World. And in looking at that from a philanthropic view, he's put together some amazing concepts on how that works. And we see lots of guys like that all over the world. We could name off lists and lists of people that are out there doing it, and they're thriving because of it, as are the artists and other people that they're working with. And in my opinion, I don't see another way of doing business. And if you're doing business in a way that's exploiting another people group or whatever it is, it doesn't matter if you're a major car company or insurance company or a jewelry company. If you're not doing it ethically, in my mind, it's cheating. It's really not that great of a business. I don't care what your bottom line looks like. So this is the way I believe business should be done and as was intended to be in the first place.
One of the things that's really interesting about this is that, you know, I'm big on sort of challenging the perceptions that we have by default of the world. And as somebody who, as I mentioned before, I've never been to Africa, so I largely have the perception that has been handed to me from various folks of what is there. And you're right that our perception is sort of the poorest of the poor, but there's this weird and very prominent issue that it seems like you're dealing with, which is the middle class is not doing so great because, as you said, there aren't all these opportunities, but nobody pays attention to sort of the middle or the lower middle class because they're so focused on the poor, the poorest of the poor. And by creating these opportunities, it's a way of solving that problem in a way that can eventually perpetuate itself once it gets rolling.
Absolutely. There's a lot of, yeah, a lot of different sides of this. And that's certainly a very important side of it as well.
Can you take me through a little bit more of the mechanics? Because I'm just thinking, like, if somebody's listening to this and their brain's kind of percolating and taking a charitable concept and turning it into a business or something, from the devil's advocate position, I'm thinking, well, do you ever run into vendors who are totally unreliable? I mean, I know that you leave, like, production and patents or whatever with the vendors, that that's not something that you take over and then produce. So what is the process for making sure that somebody can deliver and not leave Keza looking really bad by, you know, some quirk of fate?
It's tough. I mean, it's definitely a case-by-case basis. Everyone that we work with, we check out for quite a while and do our own little recon on, and much of that incognito, very much under the radar. I don't mean to sound all KGB about it, but... I mean, we do go in and do a lot of internal investigation unbeknownst to them before we even go in or before they even know that we came in. So we do a lot of checking up on them. We also do a lot of auditing. They sign an MOU with us that says that we will come and audit them randomly anytime and reserve the right to do so as long as they're producing products for us. So we can drop in at any moment, and we do that often. And we also send in other locals that are there that they would not know that would come in and check on them. So there's a lot of security checks and balances and things like that. That covers a lot of the ethical side of it. And then on the production side of it, we also check people out quite a bit to see what they're able to produce in the first place. And we also do a few test runs before we even entertain doing a larger run for a vendor on this side. And then we're there to facilitate, especially if it's a large order, we'll go there and actually be in the workshop to help facilitate large orders that need special instructions and things like that. Ultimately, sure, it can happen where we mess up an order or whatever, but even in the quote-unquote regular fashion world, that happens.
Right.
Prada does that from time to time on deadlines. And the fashion industry inherently has these really messed up timelines that happen. Everything is always last minute. You know, some of that's kind of intrinsic in the industry itself, but, you know, we make it work. You know, in 5 years, we've never had one that was too crazy. We did an order for QVC once that almost killed us, but it didn't. And then we had a really good profit margin that came out of it. So it was great. It was one of the best retail sales things we ever did.
QVC is a weird juggernaut, isn't it? It's I used to unload trucks at UPS, and it was like, if you got a QVC truck, you were just screwed. There was so much stuff.
It's like a city, man. It's not our target demographic now. That was back when we were test marketing, and we figured that was not the route that we wanted to go. But it does make sense for a lot of businesses because they sell loads of product.
I'll bet. So just sort of as a closing question then, if the people that are listening to this are aspiring profitable idealists, they're either people with businesses who want to add an idealist component, or they're idealists who want to make some money, or they're people who just want to get something going and want it to fit both ends. So what would be your advice? I mean, are there areas that you have seen that you think are sort of ripe for this kind of business? Is there any tips that you would have on sort of starting your own thing for anybody?
It depends on where you, like, if you're looking just to create a business to do good, or if you're looking to take your business and do it in a way that ends up being good, taking the business that you're currently running and making it more ethically based or whatever. There are ways to do that. But I mean, if you're looking to go and create something that is philanthropic or whatever, It's a Chinese poem that we use that anybody that's saying, hey, I want to do this, I want to go out and create a ethical business, typically what we say is this Chinese poem. I'll read it to you real quick.
Okay.
Go to the people, live among them, learn from them, love them, start with what you know, build on what they have. But of the best leaders, when their task is done, the people will remark, we have done it ourselves. And that's definitely how we try to do everything at Keza, is to do it in a way where we're going there, listening to what they've got. And it seems to be an element that's very often left out, is the listening part. We create plans for Africa from boardrooms in Washington, D.C. And that's not how to make it happen. We've created Keza out of 5 years of living on the ground in Rwanda and in surrounding areas, just to figure out the platform and the structure and the methodology in which we work. And 5 years later, now we're starting after taking all that time to listen to what they've got and build on what they have. And then again, doing it in a way where at the end, they're looking at themselves and their communities, looking at them, saying, these guys did this, not a bunch of white folks from America.
Right. Yeah. And based on everything that we've been talking about, I don't see how your business model could match that poem any more closely. I mean, it sounds exact. And the other thing that's great about that is there's no shortage of opportunities to go and, quote, live among the people for anybody who's looking to do anything that maybe is charitable with a profitable component or depending on which side is bigger. But yeah, I mean, there's no shortage of opportunities to do that. So excellent. All right, so Jared, thanks very much for talking to us. Everybody, check out keza.com, Keza. Thanks again, Jared, for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me, man. I appreciate it. It was an honor.
All right, take care, and this is Johnny B. Truant signing off.